You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you could be a tree, what kind of tree would you be? Oh, I forgot, this is a business show. Let's try that again. If you could be an internet company or a hamburger chain, what kind would you be? Even corporations can have an identity crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 4th of April. Good to have you with us. Yahoo today announced it's going to lay off 14% of its workforce. That's 2,000 employees. They were all supposed to get pink slips today. This is the sixth major layoff in 4 years for Yahoo. The internet company says it's going to focus on its core purpose. But with the online world changing at warp speed, just what is Yahoo these days? Marketplace's Adrian Hill explores the company's identity crisis.
Yahoo still gets a lot of traffic. Nielsen ranks it as the third top web brand in the U.S., behind Google and Facebook. But Yahoo is not one of the cool kids.
Yahoo and its traffic, even though it's large, is no longer fashionable.
That's e-marketer analyst David Hellerman. Part of the problem, he says, is Yahoo's identity.
Their identity today is very hard to define in that you think of the top sites, you think Facebook, you know, social media, you think Google, even though they have their hands in other things, you think search.
Yahoo used to be the convenience store of the online world, the portal where you could check your email, scan the headlines, do a quick search. But today, people don't use the web that way. They cherry pick. And Yahoo is left doing some soul searching.
What to do, how to act, basically. What choices to make.
Philip Birnbaum Moore is a professor at USC's Marshall School of Business. He thinks Yahoo's got to focus up. But on what? The analysts I talked to didn't all agree. Here's IDC analyst Karsten Vida.
There are three areas that are kind of hot, which Yahoo needs to focus on.
He says mobile, social, and video services. Hellerman thinks the company could do well to concentrate on ad sales. But one thing everyone seems to agree on, a successful Yahoo will likely be a smaller one. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Now to some corporate soul-searching in the world of burgers and fries. Burger King's been struggling, and not for the first time. A year and a half ago, private equity investors bought it and took it off the stock market, also not for the first time. Their plan? Broaden the customer base beyond men in their 20s, chomping down bacon and cheddar double stackers. Burger King's new owners plan to take the chain public again soon. But will this latest move help the chain fry and frappe their way to a comeback? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Harry Balzer is a vice president at the NPD Group, where he tracks how Americans eat. Recently, he walked into a Burger King in Glendale, California. It was pretty spiffy.
Digital menu boards up there, a TV in there. People were smiling. It impressed me. It tasted better because the place looked newer.
Burger King's owner, the private equity firm 3G Capital, has spent the past 18 months plotting a Hollywood makeover for the fast food chain. Burger King's ads now feature the swoon-worthy David Beckham and Salma Hayek. The menu has grown to include chicken strips, frappe coffees, salads, and smoothies.
And yet I still had a double cheeseburger.
Balzer is just like the consumers he studies. He likes seeing something new, but sticks to ordering his favorites. That's certainly true of the various private equity firms that have owned Burger King over the past decade. They like one formula: buy the company, take it off the public stock exchange, then cash out by listing it on the exchange again. Here's Technomic analyst Darren Tristano.
My first reaction was, would you just make up your mind already? Public, private, public, private.
But is Burger King ready for prime time? Last year, it was only half as profitable as it was in 2009. Here's RJ Hadavi, a senior restaurant analyst for Morningstar.
I think I would have liked to have seen more progress on any turnaround.
The chain has fallen to third place behind McDonald's and Wendy's. Hadavi's take on Burger King's bid to be public again?
This is more of a situation where 3G is looking to make a profit off their investment more than it is Burger King needing the capital.
So Burger King, the company, has now been flipped more often than the flame-broiled burgers it serves. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, stocks were down. Maybe the market's got identity issues, too. We'll have details when we do the numbers. We all suspect it, but now doctors are saying it. A lot of the medical tests that physicians order are unnecessary and add hundreds of millions of dollars to the annual cost of healthcare. Nine medical boards today named 45 tests and procedures that should be performed less often, everything from repeat colonoscopies less than 10 years after the first one to early MRIs for moderate back pain. Dr. James Fasoulis is with the American College of Cardiology, one of the medical boards that put out these new guidelines today. Dr. Fasoulis, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why is this happening? Why do doctors order these tests if they are unnecessary?
Well, I think it's two things. It's one, expectations of patients, and another, it tends to be the clinical habits of the community. The big part of today was patient education, because a lot of studies are done because of patient expectation. We're in a society that thinks more is better. And in this case, more doesn't necessarily help in your diagnosis. It may actually lead to going down the wrong paths and be detrimental.
I think a lot of patients assume that part of this is, one, fear of malpractice, and two, that doctors can make more money if they order more tests. Is that not true?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that it'd be true to both, but I would also say that what the doctor really wants to do is take care of the patient. And the first thing they do when they get up in the morning is not think how many of these studies they have to do to make money for that day. They want to do what's right by that patient. Now, the malpractice issue kind of gets inculcated and ingrained into the habit of the community. But what we're talking about is upwards of $300 billion a year that are tests that don't lead to any improvement in the care of the patient. And, you know, that's a big chunk of buck when you look at it.
You know, last time a government panel came out with guidelines suggesting less testing, and this had to do with mammograms in 2009, it created a real political backlash for the Obama administration and charges of rationing care. Are these recommendations a form of rationing?
Not really. They are helpful to make the right decision at the right time with the right patient and shouldn't be viewed as neither rationing nor as directing care of the patient. If they really need that test, by all means, go ahead and get it, but a thoughtful process for obtaining these tests.
Let me ask you, from your experience, you work in pediatric cardiology. I'm just wondering, though, if some of this, a lot of the patient pressure, is it coming mostly from older patients, or is it across the board?
Well, I think it's across the board. I always joke that the most difficult thing when I was teaching the residents is always having someone in the room who knew more than you did, and that was the mother. And so the mother has a lot of, sorry about that, but the mother has an expectation about what the care is. And we've become a society that almost feels you can't make a diagnosis without a test.
Let me go back just real quickly to what you said. I have to defend mothers.
I have a mother, and she's going to hear this.
Because I probably have been one of those pushing for more tests once in a while. My experience is that people push for more tests because sometimes they're not given enough information by doctors and an explanation of why they're not giving the tests.
Exactly. I think that's the next step here, that we actually have put tools together that can be used by the physician with the patient in the room. But I think the real helpful thing will be a tool that will be on a like a laptop or a tablet that the doc can take into the family and actually show this is what's going on and this is what we're going to do. And if they ask about the test, you can actually pull up the guidelines, the appropriate use criteria, and say these aren't really needed right now. We're going to be doing this instead.
Dr. James Fasulis is with the American College of Cardiology. Dr. Fasulis, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Time for Food for 9 Billion. It's our year-long look at the global challenge we face feeding the world. The Earth's population is now 7 billion. It'll be 9 billion by 2045. And with 1 in 7 people currently hungry, the question is, how are we going to feed them? One of the world's most recent success stories is the country of Brazil, where a government program called Zero Hunger has received a lot of attention for reducing hunger in that country. Here's reporter Cecilia Weissman with a question. What can Brazil teach the world?
People in Brazil have been fighting hunger since the 1940s, when hunger was endemic, especially in rural Brazil. But it wasn't until 2003 that things started to change. That's when the leftist union leader, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, was elected president. Lula, as he's known, grew up in poverty and was hungry as a child. One of the first things he did as president was make food a basic human right of the Brazilian people. Zero Hunger was the program he created to feed them. One of the places in Brazil people exercise their right to food is in Belo Horizonte, a city of 2.5 million people in central Brazil. This is popular restaurant number 2. It's one of 5 government-run cafeterias in the city, where you can get a heaping plateful of hot food for only 2 reais. That's about $1.10. When the doors open at 11, people start streaming in. This used to be only for poor people. But now, college students sit next to senior citizens and construction workers next to homeless people. There are nurses from the hospital across the street having lunch here, and cops in uniforms. On the menu today, rice, beans, ground beef, salad, and an apple. In an hour and a half, more than 4,000 people get lunch. This happens 3 times a day. 5 days a week.
This program is essential because of the ups and downs of capitalism.
That's manager Carlos Enrique Siqueira.
One day I might need this if I'm unemployed. Tomorrow you might need it.
It's this idea that government has a responsibility to offer healthy, inexpensive food to anybody who might need it. That's key to the Zero Hunger strategy. The former mayor of Belo Horizonte, Patrus Ananias, started the food programs in 1993.
Food is the most basic human right.
When Lula came into power and saw what Ananias and others were doing, he said, let's take it nationwide. He created a ministry to fight hunger. And with a budget of $2 billion a year, the Zero Hunger team set out to create a national food safety net. But they quickly realized something really important. Food programs are not enough. Riding the momentum that put him in office, Lula turned Zero Hunger into a vast web of social services.
It is the cash transfers that have had a key role in reducing poverty.
Cash transfers literally mean giving poor people money. If you go to Brazil today, people have almost forgotten about Zero Hunger. That's because it's morphed into Bolsa Família.
Eu recebo Bolsa Família.
Regiane Correa dos Santos is a perfect example of how the program's changed and how it's helping ordinary Brazilians. Correa dos Santos is 32 years old, has 3 young kids, and makes about $260 a month working as a maid. That puts her below the poverty line for a family of 4 and makes her eligible for an extra $40 a month in cash from the government. It isn't much, she says, but the extra cash does help. She opens her refrigerator. It's almost empty. When the government check arrives, which should be any day now, Correa dos Santos says she'll buy milk and meat. But here's where Bolsa Família could make a real difference in the long term. To get the monthly cash, Correa dos Santos must have her kids immunized and enrolled in school. This is causing a cultural shift in Brazil. Correa dos Santos never went to school. Now all three of her kids do. And in Brazil, with the booming economy, that means more opportunities.
Então, Bolsa Família ajudou muito. Ajudou muito.
Our lives have changed a lot after Bolsa Família, she says. This is happening in families across Brazil. Cash transfers reach nearly one quarter of Brazil's 200 million people. Since 2003, 23 million Brazilians have been lifted out of poverty. Marcelo Neri, an economist in Rio de Janeiro, says all the programs are adding up.
There is really a remarkable increase of income in Brazil, in the rural parts of Brazil, a sharp fall of poverty, an increase of the so-called middle class.
Over the past decade, Brazil has spent more than $35 billion on fighting hunger. Most of it was given directly to poor people. How do they pay for that? Simple. Economic growth. Since Lula came into power, Brazil has created more than 10 million jobs, discovered major oil fields, and the country's agricultural exports have become among the largest in the world. Lula and his successor, Dilma Rousseff, are both leftists, but they've aggressively supported big business and economic expansion and given some of the proceeds to the poor. Lula came into power making hunger a priority. He figured out what he needed to do, and he did it.
So I think the Brazilian story is a beautiful story. Of course, what we have to discuss is how to make these changes more sustainable.
So what can the world learn from Brazil about fighting hunger?
There is no general formula. There's no silver bullet.
José Graziano da Silva was Lula's Minister of Food Security. Now he's Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Graziano da Silva's first challenge is figuring out how other countries without booming economies can create the political will and find the resources to attack hunger and poverty.
We need a big web of the whole society involved. It's not only the government that fights hunger. Civil society, private sector, has an important role to play in this game.
In other words, the key is that all of society needs to work together to make fighting hunger a priority. In Belo Horizonte, I'm Cecilia Weissman for Marketplace.
Check out the rest of our Food for 9 Billion series on our website at marketplace.org.
Coming up, the Spaniards are they're very much about the outward appearance of things. And Apple fits right into that.
Despite austerity in Spain, they gotta have that iPad. But first, let's do the numbers. Nagging worries over Europe weighed on stocks around the globe today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tanked 124 points, almost 1%, to finish at 13,074. The NASDAQ fell 45 points, nearly 1.5%, and the S&P 500 shed 14 points, just over 1%. Financials helped lead the sell-off. Citigroup bled 3.75%. Morgan Stanley ditched 3.5%. Tech stocks got zapped. SanDisk chipped off more than 11% on word the flash memory maker would miss revenue projections. But Yahoo bucked the trend. Shares rose more than 0.5% after the company announced those cost-cutting layoffs. A disappointing bond sale in Spain sparked concerns Europe's debt woes could deepen. The German DAX and the French CAC 40 each dropped more than 2.75%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell about 2.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Retail therapy leading into spring. Chain stores report sales for March. Golfers tee off in Augusta, Georgia as the 2012 Masters Tournament gets underway. And a reflection on love and marriage. Married with Children premiered on April 5th, 1987. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. As this year's presidential campaign begins to take shape, we'll no doubt be hearing more about government regulation. The Republicans say it's too much. The Democrats say there's too little, from the environment to the financial sector. That last one is especially controversial in the wake of the 2008 economic meltdown. But commentator Robert Reich says the debate over financial regulation often ignores the elephant in the room, the sheer size of our biggest banks.
Last week, the Dallas Fed issued an explosive report predicting America will face another financial crisis and be forced to bail out Wall Street again unless the biggest banks are broken up. This isn't the Occupy movement. The Dallas Fed is one of the most conservative banks in the Federal Reserve System, and it knows firsthand about the dangers of underregulated banks. The savings and loan crisis of the 1980s and 90s affected Texas like nowhere else. According to the Dallas Fed report, Wall Street's power makes it almost impossible to control because, I'm quoting now, they have the lawyers and the money to resist the pressures of federal regulation. This means the Dodd-Frank Act, which is supposed to prevent another financial calamity, is woefully inadequate. Wall Street seems intent on proving the Dallas Fed correct. At this very moment, its legion of lobbyists is pushing legislation in Congress to weaken provisions in the Dodd-Frank law regulating the trading of derivatives. Meanwhile, the same lobbyists are swarming over the regulatory agencies charged with implementing Dodd-Frank. They've been trying to weaken other provisions, like the so-called Volcker Rule that bars banks from gambling with commercial deposits. The Volcker Rule is now riddled with loopholes large enough for the bankers to drive their Ferraris through. Where they haven't yet eviscerated Dodd-Frank, Wall Street's lawyers have been going to court to stop it. Recently, they delayed a rule by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to limit speculation in commodities such as oil. Clearly, Wall Street hasn't learned its lesson. The public will not tolerate another financial meltdown and bailout. And yet, Wall Street won't accept more regulation. If it's too big to fail and too powerful to regulate, the only answer is, according to the Dallas Fed, and again I'm quoting, breaking up the nation's biggest banks into smaller units. We did it to the giant oil companies a century ago because they were too powerful, economically and politically. It's time to apply the same medicine to Wall Street.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Tell us what you think. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. That Spanish bond auction we mentioned in the numbers, well, it was sort of a bust and just the latest bad news for a country suffering the highest unemployment rate in Europe right now. That rate could hit 25% this year. But amid all the belt tightening in Spain, a strange thing is happening. Spaniards are buying pricey iPhones and iPads like mad, and Apple has taken note. Lauren Freire reports from Madrid.
This is Madrid's Puerta del Sol, a sprawling downtown square that often swells with protesters, angry about education cuts, labor reforms, and most of all, unemployment, which affects one in four people here and nearly half of 20-somethings. In this same square, construction is underway on Apple's flagship store in Spain. You see, even unemployed Spaniards seem to scrounge up cash for iPhones. Juan Aberling is a pilot who just lost his job.
What's a crisis? I mean, you study a lot and you can't fly and...
But you still have your iPhone.
I still have my iPhone, yes. It's worth paying it, yes, I know. And honestly, if this breaks now, in 1 week I will buy another one. Really.
Despite the crisis, Spaniards bought 800,000 iPhones in the first three quarters of last year, 60% more than the previous year, even though retail sales countrywide have fallen for 18 straight months. Those against the odds sales are what Apple looks at when it decides to expand into a stalled, debt-ridden economy like Spain's. That, and Spaniards' tendency toward conspicuous consumption, says economist Gail Allard.
When you walk around in Spain and you see how well-dressed people are and how good their cars look and what nice cars they drive. You know, they don't have a dented fender and they don't have a bad paint job. You know, the Spaniards are they're very much about the outward appearance of things. And Apple fits right into that. These are beautiful products. They're not just functional, they're beautiful.
It's the classic nouveau riche syndrome. 30 years ago, Spain was still a poor country. Now Spaniards are basically on par with the rest of Europe, and they relish brand names. Sales of luxury goods were actually up 40% here last year. That doesn't surprise Juan with his iPhone.
I think if people just see the Apple, the brand on it, it's like, wow, he has an Apple, and yeah, it's worth it.
All 5 Apple stores in Spain have opened in the past year and a half during the economic crisis. That's compared to 33 Apple outlets total in Britain, seen as a more secure investment than Spain. But even on a Tuesday morning, this Apple store on the outskirts of Madrid is packed. Victor Salent, an engineer who helped design the store's layout, takes me on a tour.
Muy buen marketing.
Very good marketing, he says. Look at this Apple store. It's something different in technology. The very space where you shop, all the details, including even the tables where you can test the Macs. So welcoming. Spain has its big department store, El Corte Inglés, and mom-and-pop local places. But chains have only been here a few decades, and none are like Apple, Salent says. So Spaniards are quick converts.
De personas con rentas bajas.
Of the people with really low salaries or who are even out of work, he says, they all have smartphones. Back in Madrid's Central Plaza, Oliver Romero, 26 and jobless, smokes a cigarette on the stoop of a 19th century building that'll be an Apple store this spring. He says he's thinking of applying for a job there.
The crisis is bad, of course, but it's not a matter of we're in crisis, we don't have money, we can't spend any money. It's a matter of how we deal with the money we have.
With that, he pulls out his iPhone and starts surfing. In Madrid, I'm Lauren Freyer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note today, anybody who's ever waited tables can feel her pain. A waitress in Moorhead, Minnesota, lost what she calls a $12,000 tip. The mother of 5 was working her shift at the Moorhead Frying Pan when a customer left a takeout box behind. The customer told the waitress to keep it. Well, it turns out the box contained $12,000 in cash. The waitress turned it in to police, and they told her she could keep it if no one claimed it after a while. But now police are keeping the money as part of a drug investigation. The waitress, you guessed it, is now suing. And that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. You can always reach us at marketplace.org. Also, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.